Yes, you can.
Can I tune in?
Yes, you can.
Can I tune in?
Yes, you can.
Can I tune in?
Yes, you can. East Leeds Community Radio.
So today on East Leeds Community Radio, I'm very excited to welcome, coming all the way from Utah, we've got a composer, mayor, punk rocker, professor, all in one person. This is Philip Bimstein. Welcome, Philip.
Yeah. Hi, Tony. Thank you for having me. It's good to be with you.
Your work caught my attention because we've been really exploring here at East Leeds Community Radio, Chapel FM, the whole notion of how can you bring together people's stories, especially recorded voices, oral histories, and other art forms, music, but also theater, even visual arts, things like that. As a composer, as a musician, you've have a fantastic track record of doing that sort of thing in ways that I found really creative and interesting. Then also discovered we share a hometown as well, which we'll talk about, I'm sure, a bit later on. But those four titles that I mentioned at the beginning, just to kind of set the scene. So I love a good unlikely combination of titles that you wouldn't expect to come together. You know, punk rocker and mayor, that already alone probably puts you in a fairly small category. So tell us set the scene briefly about who you are and what kind of life have you had. How does music fit together with things like being a mayor?
Wow. Well, music fits together with everything for me. Yep. Let's see, just briefly. Born in Chicago and had a punk rock new wave band. Well, I studied classical music at the conservatory and got a degree in that. And I've written classical music and experimental music. But in Chicago, I had a new wave punk rock band. And then I moved to, I went to LA and studied film composing. And I wrote a few things, but I didn't really feel like staying with that. So I moved to Utah, where I live now. And let's see. After moving to Springdale, Utah, some of your listeners may have been to Zion National Park, a beautiful place in southern Utah. And I loved it. So I moved there and lived there for 5 years. And then they elected me mayor. And I served for 8 years. It was an unusual turn. The town had been very polarized and divided. And I was the head of the local arts council. And people felt like the arts council was the only thing positive happening in town. Hmm. And so they asked me to run for mayor. And I did. And it worked out really well. Served 2 terms. And well, that kind of bridges into the professor part, because while I was mayor, I noticed analogies between the way in which music, dialogue, and community work. In particular, one example is I chair a town meeting, and I noticed that the way it evolved was just like a sonata allegro form, which is a very specific form with a theme, a contrasting theme, and then a development section where those themes are played around with and altered, and then a recapitulation. And this was just like that, where somebody would rise and say, I want to change the zoning on my land, and then somebody else would say, well, I think we should keep that as green space. So those are the two contrasting themes. And then it evolved like a development section and a Beethoven symphony, and where things would go back and forth. So I noticed a lot of things. I noticed the way that the best way a conversation or a town meeting worked is when people collaborated like a jazz band or a bluegrass ensemble, listening and being available to riff on what the previous person said, etc. So that led to me coming up with the idea of coming to the University of Utah and saying, I'd like to teach a course on this. Could I do it? And they let me do it. And that was 12 years ago. And over the years, I kept coming up with new courses, and they became popular. And so when all my friends are retiring, the university made me full time, about 4 years ago. So did I leave anything out? Let's see. Composer, professor, punk rocker, and mayor. I think I covered it.
It did brilliantly. And this notion that the forms of art, and particularly with music for all kinds of reasons, right, has those structures. I mean, structures in general, it's something we talk a lot about here, that this balance between how society works, how groups of people come together, and how conversations happen. And when they're, there's a sense sometimes people have that, well, things just happen, they just unfold. But so often, if you're not aware of the structure, there's always a structure there. It's just a question of whether you're aware of it and trying to use it in a constructive way or not. So it's something that's really interesting to us here at the Art Center in Leeds, and how those things play out in, you know, again, whether you're preparing for a performance or trying to organize a big political campaign or govern a community in some way.
Yeah, well, I agree. I'm glad you mentioned structures, because Sonata Allegro is just one. But yeah. Even a blues form, which is basically AAB, or theme and variations, or, you know, different kinds of song structures. And, you know, and I write songs too. So, I'm very aware of structure. And even when you have a free jazz improvisation, there is still being built on previous structures in one way or another.
The particular topic we're focusing on, and this is a series of radio broadcasts that we're doing, gathering together. If you're listening to this, by the way, though, we're building an archive of these conversations, has to do with this, in some ways, quite specific idea, which is what happens if you take someone's voice, recording of people, someone talking, telling a story or just talking about themselves or their lives, and then in some way use that as a kind of creative source to mix together with music in some way, or to create music around that voice or somehow with that voice. It's something that, you know, I've been thinking about for quite a while. We've been talking about, there are different ways of referring to it. It doesn't have one universally agreed name that I'm aware of. I mean, when you work this way, do you tend to call it anything in particular, or to distinguish it from other kinds of music where you might be writing for someone to just sing or set to music versus the idea of taking a pre-recorded, an oral history of sorts?
I think when I do the voice work, I used to sometimes think of them to myself as musical portraits. I'm glad that you also said that it could be not, you know, to create music out of the voices, because that's what I do. And I remember when I wrote my very first piece like this, Garland Hersey's Cows, by the way, I should also mention, it was because I know your show is also interested in community, and that's part of how I got to know my community before I was mayor. I got to know my neighbor Garland Hersey, because I got fascinated by his voice. That, you know, I had him come over to talk to me about his cows, who I was going to write a piece about, but I got intrigued by his voice. It had a beautiful lilt to it, and he had a sense of humor and a warmth. And I said, Garland, I'd like you to be in my piece too, if you would be willing. So I interviewed him. I had no plans to do this, no idea that this would be my career path for the next, 10 or 15 years. But I found that I loved it, because I would sit down there in my studio listening to his voice after I recorded it, like in the same way that you do, except I would listen over and over and over again. And I would listen for different, I think, two different main things: the meaning of what he says, you know, the story and the meaning of it, which you could also get just from the words, but also the sound of his voice, and that included the pitch, the texture, the tonal quality, and the direction of, like, whether it moved up or down at certain times, and rhythmic patterns. And that's what I sat down to do then. I thought, I wrote music that flowed out of those patterns and those sorts of the tone too. You see, so it's like not just a technical thing, it's the emotional tone of the voice that then would inform the kind of music that I would come up with.
You want to know a little about, a little bit about, you want to know a little about, a little bit about, you want to know a little about, a little bit about, a little bit about my cows, 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 a little bit about my cows. Well, tell you, a little bit about my cows, a little bit about my cows, a little bit about my cows.
I got a brought to me 45 in.
Well, I'll tell you.
Well, there's a lot of different cows. I got some Shirley. That's a yellow one. Angus, they're black. Black. And then Hereford is red.
There's a lot of different cows.
Well, I'll tell you a little bit about my cows.
So that was the opening section of Garland Hershey's Cows, composed by Philip Bimstein, who we're talking with here about this very particular, but to me, absolutely lovely and expansive idea of composing with and around people's voices and stories. So you've written pieces on fantastic, and just the, again, the mix, the types of stories and voices. You know, we have casinos and baseball stadium beer salespeople, Native Americans, young people in prison and detention. Just a few of the different themes. But let's talk about those last two that I mentioned, because they both of them, I think, in quite specific, quite strong ways, involve a high level of trust that you're being given somebody's story, somebody's voice as an element in a composition. So maybe just let's start with Dark Winds and tell us about that composition, that project.
Yeah, it's a little different from some of the others because I don't. Another thing I didn't mention is that when I write these musical portraits, and we've talked about the voices, but I also like to include sounds of their environment. Like in Garland Hershey, it's his cows, his casino, it's slot machines, roulette wheels, etc. But with Dark Winds Rising, I didn't include natural sounds. There are a few odd sounds every now and then, including a ratcheting sound in one movement, that are actually all out of artifacts of the voice. Like a little whistling sound that I pick up, or when somebody goes, like if I'm pausing and I go, like that. And if you take that sound, there's like a nice texture to it. So, but anyway, to get to like what the piece is about, well, before I was mayor, but there's a Kaibab Paiute reservation about 60 miles from my home. And I'd heard that they were having this hearing about of the whole reservation to consider whether or not to accept an offer from a company called Waste Tech to build a toxic waste incinerator on their reservation. And this company had gone around and built it on a couple others around the country, and now they were offering it to this Kaibab Paiute tribe who are very poor, and they were offering them $50,000 a year for life, I believe, each. And so I went to the hearing, and it was, so a lot of people got up to speak about the environmental impact, the economic impact, et cetera, et cetera. But one young man named Verdell Jake, I learned later, who was about 17 at the time, got up and read a poem. That was, everyone was getting up and talking about facts and things. He just read a poem that expressed his hurt, his sense of that this could even be considered, this might happen. And so that gave me the idea to write a piece that would, well, actually it was several weeks or months later when they had their vote and they voted down this toxic waste incinerator in favor of the six or seven generations of the future of their tribe and for their health and welfare. And I was inspired by that to write a piece about it. So the first person I thought of was Verdell Jake. And I called him, and he was a little wary. A white guy coming in to like want to get his story, like he was a little wary, but he warmed up. And I ended up interviewing his aunt, Vivienne, and his grandmother, Lucille. And they're each in the different movements. So this is one where I really wanted to take care, because now they're really telling the story of their whole tribe, their whole history, and what's sacred to them. So I didn't want to use any other sounds except sounds that emanated from their voice. And again, very much, even more than Garland Hershey's Cows, a lot of the music is really based on the rhythms and patterns and pitches of their voices.
And in the process of that close, deep listening, and I imagine that means going back and listening to that same bit of tape, you know, dozens, hundreds of times.
Yes.
You know, there's a notion of deep listening, which is another quite an interesting concept. I mean, I'm so intrigued. I mean, occasionally here in our world too, where I even just editing a bit of audio sometimes for a broadcast, where I go back and hear something 10, 15 times. And it hits me occasionally, even after the 12th time I've listened to something, I realized, oh, wait a second, I completely missed that little word that they slipped in between this part and that part that changes the meaning of what they said. Or I'm just catching that something, how much information there is in somebody's voice that maybe we're catching it all or a lot of it subconsciously, subliminally, but how much of it just flows past us. But it's there, it's available if we're doing that deep listening. And I imagine in your case, it's also an exercise and almost a kind of a meditation, I suppose, right?
It can be. And, you know, deep listening, I don't know if you're referring to the deep listening of Pauline Oliveros.
Yeah.
I went to three of her retreats in
New
Mexico. I did, yeah.
Brilliant.
Yeah. Oh. Yeah, but anyway, go ahead.
I was just kind of putting it now as a question in terms of, what else? I guess just what else? The kinds of things that you discover, or the kind of this chains of thoughts that get set in motion through this kind of process.
Well, in this case, in Dark Winds Rising, you know, the Native American, Garland Hershey, there was my pieces also are shaped by sort of a meta thing about the person. Garland Hershey's kind of a whimsical person, the way he talks, his the way he even hears things, the way he approaches life. And so I wrote a very whimsical piece. Dark Winds Rising is about a serious topic, but not to say that like Vivian in particular could be quite whimsical. She and I became friends. But there's I think in this case, there's more things like hurt, you know, and especially in the first movement, The Last Jake, a lot of hurt in Verdell's voice. But in Vivienne, there was more like a tenderness, you know, when she talks about walking barefooted in the summertime and go to the rocks and listen to them. There's a spirit and a tenderness that I picked up from her. And then with the grandmother, Lucille, even though she's not a in-your-face type of resistor, you can hear a strong resistance in her to the and she says, you know, even the idea, there's not even the idea of an incinerator. There's not going to be one. And, so to hear her resolve. And so I tried to reflect, you know, all of those things in the music that I wrote, and in the way in which there's another aspect, again, that you would be quite familiar with. It's in the editing of their story, because I may speak to them for, in this case, three people, so probably 3 hours. And then I may only use a total of 5 or 10 minutes of what they say. So it's choosing what they say and knitting together things from maybe in the first 10 minutes of the interview that followed by something they said in the last 15 minutes. But it's like listening for the story that evolves from those repeated listenings, like you said. And I write out everything that they say as well, so I can both hear it as well as just kind of look at it and draw lines between things and stuff. So it's looking for the story that evolves from the interview and from the people.
really, the way you just described it and all those different examples and so specific, which is so helpful. And I think to go back and listen to those pieces then with some of that just adds other layers of complexity to it. But particularly around a topic like this, I mean, Native Americans, land being used in yet again another example of, you know, completely misappropriation of land, in this case, also, you know, sacred land as well. But the trusting of the stories. And there's often a sense that the media, or even in many cases art, right, can take someone else's story, and, you know, it's a very complicated process and it can very often go wrong. I mean, particularly in the case of the media, I mean, people are often quite hesitant to talk to the media because there's a sense that you lose control. But
well, I just want to say about editing, I just want to clarify, and I'm sure you got this, but yeah, for your listeners, like, editing can usually mean sort of making something more concise, getting rid of extra stuff, and maybe finding the nitty gritty or something like that. But in my case, what I mean is, I don't mean it editing in that way. I would have better used the word knitting together.
Yeah.
So it's not so much editing as it's selecting and hearing what's important and what flows together, and knitting that together to hopefully get at the heart of the story that I hear in the voice and their story. So I'll change editing to knitting together.
Nice. Well, I love that the conversation created a bit of editing of the description, and editing to knitting together is great. And I think, you know, one of the things too that's also interesting about when we talk about sound in general and the human voice is that we don't really have the vocabulary to match the complexity of some of these things, which sometimes can be make it more difficult to describe. But what it also means is that we have to constantly be thinking about, well, what should we call this particular thing? And so, yeah, the knitting together becomes, you know, we may borrow that and use that in some of our work here, if you don't mind.
Not at all.
No, that's great.
Weaving is another word. Weaving.
Weaving is, but yeah.
Yeah. Same sort of thing. Yeah.
And the other thing that I think, and if people listen to these, is also the role of, and it varies from piece to piece, but of repetition. There's something, you know, in the mainstream media, if they were to interview, say, one of these people you just spoke about, Lucille or the Jake family, is that the surname?
Yes, that's correct.
Yeah. Would if anything, just, you know, take a longer section and cut it down. They certainly would never repeat certain phrases multiple times again and again. But often in these music pieces, there's an element of repetition, which means that itself creates a kind of immersion and seems to me like it's a useful tool in getting people to flip their brain into that more deep listening mode.
Yes. And well, an example of that I used that way in the first movement of The Last Jake is in the middle part, where Verdell starts to say, "My grandmother always said, Verdell, come home." And I just was touched by the way he said that. And then, you know, I kind of alternated that between his own statements, but it kept coming back. I kept repeating like a chorus, like a refrain. My grandmother always said, Verdell, come home. My grandmother always said, Verdell, come home. And then I let it kind of recede a little bit in volume, but it just, for me, it keeps the tone and the feeling and the tenderness of what that meant to Verdell, to have his grandmother always say, Verdell, come home.
Well, let's hear one of the movements. And if it's okay with you, I think I feel like I could play this, the second one, the Walking Barefoot, because hearing your description of it makes me eager to hear that again. But before we hear that, I'm just going to give a shout out to your website. So anybody listening to this who wants to explore more deeply into all aspects of it, it's got composer, performer, teacher, speaker, no punk rock and mayor in there, but there's information about that side of your work as well. And you've got a fantastic, you were clearly an early adopter to the internet, I think, because you got your surname.com. So bimstein.com, bimstein.com.
That's right. And it's BIM as in Mary.
Yes, exactly. Thank you. Okay. So let's hear the second movement of Dark Winds Rising. And this is the Walking Barefoot movement.
Closer and closer, closer and closer, closer and closer.
I'm Vivian.
I'm Jake. I'm from the Kaibab Paiute Reservation. I'm a member of the tribe. My first memories are probably kicking the sand around. Walking barefooted in the summertime. Walking barefooted, never needing shoes all summer long. This is a natural world. There's a lot of unnatural things that are coming about. The black cloud was getting closer and closer, closer and closer, closer and closer, closer and closer. What now? What am I going to do? What am I going to do? What am I going to do? Even the thought of an incinerator, a deep, deep hurt inside, a feeling of doom. Like as if we were dying already. We were dead already. A deep, deep hurt inside. Deep, 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 deep hurt inside. Even the thought of an incinerator. Even the thought. You better think again. We decide our own future. You cannot possibly make those decisions for us. We'll stop you every which way I can. The Kaibab Paiute Reservation. Closer and closer, closer and closer, closer and closer. Special place. Closer and closer, closer and closer, closer and closer. Go there and look at the rocks and listen to what you're being told. If you learn to respect the animals, you can receive the messages from them. Outer self needs to experience the inner self. That's where you have your heart feelings. There's a lot of hope for you. Your strength is from within. Walking barefooted in the summertime. Walking barefooted, never needing shoes all summer long.
So we're talking with Philip Bimstein, and we just heard the second movement from the Dark Winds Rising piece. And we're talking about this funny old idea of human voices, stories, recordings, oral histories, being a catalyst for music and mixed in part of music compositions. So,
Could I just mention that was performed by the Turtle Island String Quartet?
Oh, yes. Thank you. Yeah. And did you seek them out? Did they seek you out? How did that collaboration come about?
I contacted them. I can't remember how. I think maybe in some way in Salt Lake was friends of them. This might be relevant. I first recorded their voices, the three Jakes, and didn't know what I was going to write. I don't like to decide what I'm going to write. I like it to flow out of the voices. But one decision I made early on was, you know, I don't want to do like Native American flute and drums or something, because that would be kind of appropriating their culture. And so I thought, well, what should I write? And I thought, well, let's write a string quartet. So that's how it happened. And then I mentioned it to a friend, and they knew the Turtle Island String Quartet. I contacted them, and they said, yeah, let's do it. So I wrote it for them, and they recorded it. So that's it.
I can already tell we're just scratching the surface of this topic, which I feel like we could, there's so many more examples and ruminating that we can do on it, but let's talk about two more pieces. The next one, Lockdown, which is a name that unfortunately has taken on different resonance over the last few years for all of us. But this piece, Lockdown, involves juvenile detention, and I have to say, listening to it and the clip we'll hear after we talk for a few minutes, it really gets into my spine, I have to say, on some really visceral levels, in a way that few things, do about what it really means to be locked down, to be in prison, in detention. So tell us about how this piece came to be.
Well, it came to be because when I got a three-year residency grant from Meet the Composer in New York, and the residency was in my own community, most of it was to write music based on stories and things that I experienced there. But a part of it was to do some outreach, and one of those outreach activities I elected to do was to go speak at the Washington County Youth Crisis Center, where half of it was a place for young people to escape abuse, et cetera, to be held safely. But the other half was like basically a prison, because you had to go through three locked doors and be buzzed in. But they were there for short term, most of them. One of the people in the piece that you hear was in charge in for armed robbery, but most of them are for fights or stealing things. But anyway, I would go and tell them, I would go and talk to them about creativity. And I'd say things to them like, you are all creative people. You probably got in here for doing something creative. But, there are creative things that can get you in trouble. There are creative things that can get you applause and sometimes even make some money. So I gave them examples of I said, here's some of the crazy things I do. And I played them Garden Hershey's Cows and Casino, which they loved. I said, and then I would hear their own stories. I'd go weekly. And I did this for a year or two. And I'd say, one of these days I'd like to come and do a piece about you. Of course, they change every week I come. There's a couple of new people, a couple have left. And, over a year's time, there's probably completely new people. But I eventually did. And I took my microphone and I spent a couple of different days there asking them about their lives and how they felt being in a facility and what they felt about their mothers, which became the second movement, what they want to do when they get out, and, what they feel about the justice system. And, these kids were from, I think they were as young as 11 to 17 or something like that. And, some of them had lots of attitude, and you hear that in the pieces. But some are like really kind of tender, and, they kind of don't really understand, what's going on with their lives, and that comes out in their voices. And so I wrote a different, totally, as I mentioned, I write a piece that conforms in my mind more to their stories and lives of each type of portrait. And here I used the sounds of their environment, which were very interesting types of sounds, and the sounds of handcuffs and shackles that they have to put on when they go to court every week or so to get some sort of appraisal. I used the sound of their cell doors slamming. And matter of fact, I went in one of their cells and asked them to slam the door on me so I could have the microphone get that boom sound as it closed. And they told me that sometimes in the middle of the night when they get frustrated, they take their pillows and they slam them against the metal sinks. And so I did that. And there's the buzzer sounds or alarm sounds that I turn into sort of a calliope sound, and things like that. And of course, they were amazed to see me walking around. Oh, matter of fact, I have one of them comments. I think it's in the third movement. I don't know which movement you'll play. It doesn't matter. But oh, that's right. He said, "You heard the shackles. It's not a cool sound." You see, because I was walking around thinking these were cool sounds, because here am I coming from the outside. But to them, it had a totally different meaning. And I should say, by the way, that in all of these pieces, never do I tell my subject to what to say. And never do they speak to a script, and never, it's all totally natural conversation, and then I find later, what it is that I can use. So all of these, in any of these pieces, you hear their voices, they're just talking. And well, in this case, it's different from the other pieces because it's a group of them, five or six of them together, or 10 of them at one time. I wrote three movements, and the idea is to tell the story of these youth that in a way that most people probably never hear, and maybe to bring us into their lives, and also to validate for them, as well as I've gone and taken this piece to other youth crisis centers and spoken about it, and for them to know that, like, people care about their stories. And, you know, whenever I take this to a facility and I play it, that middle movement, and I'm not saying you should play that. I think probably one of the others is better to play in a short, but where they talk about their moms, it never fails that some of the some of the young people hearing this who are incarcerated cry, you know, because it just, they go kind of recognize that's how they feel about, they miss their moms, et cetera. So it's just really been a learning experience for me to be allowed to come into their lives and to write a piece about them.
Hmm. And that fact that they were able to hear some of the other pieces that you had done before that,
yes,
in some ways even more underscores that it's not, this isn't some kind of, you know, strange magic trick, or I don't know. It's there's a collaborate. I mean, there's a sense that in, particularly in this case, right, they were aware that they were working with you, collaborating to try to communicate something together using certain skills and resources that you had that they didn't have, but also using the knowledge that they have and the experiences that they had that are so distinct. And again, there's an alchemy that allows for that to happen that's unique and requires real care to build, and the specificity of it too, which is the case of, I think, with all of these too, that, you know, every one of them, if you were to go into a different detention center in a different place on a different day, end up with completely different stories. So that also, that balance between being so specific, so unique, and then out of that, of course, they are universal as well. Mm-hmm. But universality has to be grounded in that kind of specificity to really work.
Fantastic. Well, I love the way you characterize it and the insight you have into it, because you capture that beautifully. And especially when you say it's like a collaboration, even though I do go home and sit in my studio alone, there is a sense of collaboration. And I believe they have that too, because like you said, they've heard my pieces. So they have a sense of, like, the way I work and how their story might be told. So there is a sense of collaboration about that. Thank you for noticing that.
This is great. Well, I was going to play the first movement, but I think after hearing you talk about the second movement and the mothers, I think for any listeners to hear that. Although I wanted to just quote a couple lines from the first movement, but in here there's a bit of use of irony too. So where one of the young people says, "It's fun in here. We all love it. I call this place the Holiday Inn for kids. Kids are free, right?" And then it's juxtaposed by, "This place is hell. It sucks. That's all I've got to say about it." You know, from the irony of saying it's fun in here. And of course, when you hear it, you know, you hear that this is being said in a particular way, to the absolute dead on literal meaning. But then let's hear this second movement talking about mothers, because, speaking of universal, there are few things more universal than that. So here's the second movement from Philip Imstein's piece, Lockdown.
And I know it jazzed my mom's heart up to see me in here. And that's not right. I tell her that it ain't right. Thank you.
be good, you'll be good. You know, you miss your mom. If you find somebody you love like your mom, you love her a lot. If you tell her, you'll be good, you'll be good. If you promise your mom you'll be good, you'll be good.
I know it tears my mom's heart up to see me again. That's not right. I tell her that it ain't right.
Did you tell her? Did you tell her?
I want to learn how to respect my mom. She loves me very much. She wants to help me.
Did you tell her? You'll be good. You'll be good.
I feel really bad because I hurt my mom really bad, and I love my mom's, and I want to get out and take care of my mom.
Did you tell her? Did you tell her?
You know, you miss your mom. I want to go home. I love my mom, and I want to go home.
Did you tell her? You'll be good, you'll be good. Did you tell her? Did you tell her? Did you tell her? Did you tell her? Promise your mom you'll be good, you'll be good. Did you tell her you'll be good, you'll be good. If you promise your mom you'll be good, you'll be good.
So that was the second movement of Lockdown, and we're talking with Philip Bimstein. Heading into the final stretch here. Although I would love to stay in communication and share more. And I think some of the young musicians here in Leeds who we work with and radio makers as they're exploring these ideas will be fascinated to, and we'd love to share. We'll definitely be playing some of your work for them as well.
Thank you. I'd love to stay. I thank you. And I'd love to stay in touch, and I'd love to come in there sometime and meet your young musicians there. If I could just add a couple of things about Lockdown, you know, kind of in keeping with what you said before about those lines, about the irony, they do have a good sense of irony, but there's also a tenderness in them, especially like in the last movement where one of the incarcerees says, "Tomorrow's my last day, I'll be out," you know, but then, you know, so they, I'm now saying in my own voice, they might just be thinking about, yay, I'm going to be out. But they go on to say, tomorrow's my last day, I'll be out, you know. But then everybody else is left behind. They'll be in here for like 2 more months, 3 more months, you know, another month. And you never know when they're going to get out. I wish I could leave with you, meaning like, I wish you could come with me. So they care for each other. And then also in the one end part, after about, you know, they lock us up. And one of them says, some of these people haven't even tasted cantaloupe.
And That really got me too. That line of cantaloupe. I thought, why cantaloupe? Which of course is what makes it so interesting.
Yeah, exactly. That, you know, I must have been having a conversation. So, well, what do you kind of eat? Well, you know, like I love cantaloupe, and somebody must have said, cantaloupe, what's that? You know? And so he just says it in this, and I just love the line, had to use it.
Oh, I'm glad you mentioned that, because when I listened to it too, that's one of those things that as soon as he said, some of these people have never tasted cantaloupe, it definitely lit off something in my brain as well. And I thought, what an interesting choice. Like that particular choice just made me wonder a whole set of other questions about that person. to end with, there's a lot of choices, but I thought I'd end with, you know, as I got, went back and listened to the different pieces, a piece called Larkin Gifford's Harmonica, which initially I wasn't going to do, but then as I listened to it again, I just thought there's something in his voice that's so fascinating to me, and it's one of these vocal things that will probably forever elude, you know, human language of quite what it is, although we can make an attempt to try to get at it. But maybe to start with, of who was Larkin Gifford, and how did you end up creating a piece about him and his harmonica?
Yeah, well, you know, I'd already written Garn Hershey's Cows, and Larkin Gifford is another old fellow like from my community who I knew a little bit. When I ran for mayor, I remember, you know, I went up and down the street campaigning to people's houses, and I remember the day before the election, my very last call at something like 8 o'clock at night, long day, was Larkin and Ruth Gifford's house. Mm. And she actually invited me in for a sandwich and a glass of milk, you know, and, you know, and he played the harmonica for me and said, "Here, Ruth, go get him that, you know," he said, "you play guitar." And so she got me the guitar, and I played these old folk tunes that he, you know, I just picked up like what he was playing, and we had fun for, you know, an hour. And so, you know, it was probably 8-10 years later when I thought of doing a piece about him and his harmonica. And he just told me these lovely stories about growing up and with his grandfather taking him down to the river and giving him a drink of water from his hand. He said, "I just remember that." And he had so many memories, and again, like Garland Hershey, you know, maybe it's something that goes with that neighborhood, that he had a sense of mirth about him, that good nature, good humor. He was easy to chuckle about, you know, things. And so I was just drawn to him and wanted to see if I could tell his story. Oh, and the music for that one. So I've mentioned that I use sounds of people's environment generally, but in this one, all of the music, every bit of the music that you hear, every sound other than his voice, is generated from his harmonica playing. Now, sometimes it's fairly obvious, although I might repeat a riff over and over many more times than he might have done. But and sometimes it's not obvious at all, because I part of my work is to listen to the possibility, the potentials hidden within a sound. And so I will alter it or repeat it or go zoom in on like a little detail of it. And so I could create all kinds of different tones and environments from his harmonica, and so you threaded through it are moments where you hear, yeah, that's a harmonica, but there are many moments where it's just this more of a sonic texture, but it's all created from the harmonica.
Mm. And I love
go ahead.
That phrase, the potential hidden within sound, even just the notion of the word potential, I think is in the context of everything we're talking about is a useful word to bear in mind or think about in relation to this idea of listening to someone's story and then imagining bringing it into some kind of artistic space. In this case, music, it could be being done through theater or even transformed into visual art in some way, whatever it may be.
Absolutely.
That idea of potential. Fantastic. So a quick question for, imagine a young person, a musician or someone involved in a radio space over here, setting out to do something vaguely along these lines, right? They've talked to somebody, the fishmonger down at the market or the bus driver, and they think, okay, this person seems interesting to me. They've got good stories. I like something about their voice draws me in, and I want to record them and then try to do something along these lines and set it to music. Is there anything you would give in terms of advice? Not necessarily a technical thing, but just a kind of a how to orient yourself, maybe how to get ready to think about going about this sort of thing from your many, many years of doing these kinds of pieces.
You know what? Well, I'd start with what how you just introduced the question, the idea. So first I'd say go talk to Tony. He's got some great ideas and inspirations. Fishmonger, bus driver. I think what it is, I mean, I did do one piece with an author and had her read phrases from her book and then own piece based on it. And so she's, you know, a somewhat famous person or a known person. All the others are just a person that interested me, a couple of my neighbors, you know. I went and found a guy who studied to be a Catholic priest, but then ended up calling dice at Las Vegas. And I you know, I thought, what interesting stories might he have to tell? And I think what I hope could pull your young musicians and radio people is just getting interested in the stories that are there, even sometimes in what are relatively maybe commonplace things. I mean, I feel guilty even to use that word, but what I mean is it doesn't have to be the star or the person who you know, is doing something spectacular. You know, you can find interesting stories, and sometimes you find the most interesting stories, you know, in more average sorts of places, you know, pedestrian places, right? You know, like you said, the fishmonger, your next door neighbor, you know, maybe somebody you just see on the street, you know, and you know, you don't know maybe until I've been lucky. Everyone I've set out to do a piece gave me the fruit that I was looking for, that, and maybe that wouldn't always be the case, or maybe it would. And, you know, I think what should drive what I ask, would invite any of these young people to do is, follow your curiosity, you know, tune in to your curiosity about what makes this person, I don't know, maybe not what makes them tick, but what animates this person, you know, and what, and how is that reflected in their voice and in their stories? And then listen to that voice. And I think they will find that things will reveal themselves to them.
Well, we've only been talking about one fraction of all the things you do, right? As we mentioned at the beginning, you know, mayor, musician, teacher, composer. I forget the exact quartet of things, but there are many. And then this is only one portion of that music and composer standpoint, this particular set of works, although it's a really rich, really exciting one. And, you know, I think, as I mentioned, you know, we've been and I've been exploring, poking around, looking for examples of people who bring people's voices and oral histories and music together. And there's some lovely examples out there, but I think you've explored this area as imaginatively and expansively as just about anybody that I've come across. So it's really, it's fantastic to be able to talk about these four pieces in particular, share a few examples. Hopefully people listening to this will go and explore more deeply. So again, it's, Bimstein, B-I-M, as in Mary, S-T-E-I-N, .com. And you can find out lots more about all the pieces and other aspects of your work. So before we go, and we'll hear this last piece, is there anything that we haven't touched on that you want to share in the last few minutes here?
I just thank you for, you know, giving everyone my webpage. And yeah, that's a good place to find these things, but you could also find them on Spotify and YouTube and Apple Music and so forth. But I just want to say thank you so much, Tony. You know, when you talk about how much you've been, you know, exploring and, you know, this field of people who use voices in different ways in their music and maybe in other ways to tell stories. I'm sure you're probably one of the more informed people on the planet about it because you've been researching it and studying it and interested in it. And therefore, I'm extremely honored that you have chosen me to be a part of that and that you've included me in your in this interest of yours. So thank you so much.
Well, it's been fun, a pleasure, fun listening to your work, fun getting to meet and talk a bit here. So I really enjoyed it. So we're going to go out with, I thought maybe the second movement of Larkin Gifford's Harmonica. Not quite sure why, but when I went and listened to it, it something got me there. So its title is As Plain in My Mind as Yesterday. So let's hear this one to go. So thank you again for joining us all the way from Utah to Yorkshire, Philip. Thanks.
Thank you. And our interview will remain as plain in my mind as yesterday. So thank you so much. Bye-bye.
I remember my father taking me down to the river over in Schoonsburg to give me a drink out of his hand. And I asked Father what what the occasion was. I says, I can just remember that. What was it? He said, that was your grandfather's funeral. He said, you bawled for a drink, water, and he took you down the river and gave you a drink out of your hand. That's just as plain in my mind as yesterday. Just drinking out of his hand down to the river. Just plain in my mind as yesterday. 9 years of slumbering, tick, 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 tick. Hay was down and it looked like a storm coming, and her neighbors, they rushed over and helped pitch the hay and get it on the wagon, get it into the barn before it rained on it. Oh yes, everybody helped each other. That's just as plain in my mind as yesterday. 9 years of slumbering, tick, 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 tick. Just as plain in my mind as yesterday.
3 commas. Love the apostrophes. Love the colons and the question marks. Love the words from East Leeds FM.
Nonoleta, nonoleta, per amarti, nonoleta.
peruchinho.